Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, number what episode, Katie?
600.
That's crazy.
I know.
What number did you jump on board?
I was trying to remember that, and I think, I mean, it was
Did you jump on in like the 200s or the 300s or something?
Yeah, it was in the 300s.
You were in the 300s?
Because I think it was like the late 200s, early 300s, somewhere around there.
Well, it's very exciting that that you've been a part. You know what's coming down the pipeline? Is a hostful episode where we grill you about your life. People are asking for it. They're demanding it.
I saw the tweets.
And I said to someone, like, she doesn't like talking about herself, but we're gonna make that happen.
Okay.
Or maybe you do like talking about yourself and we just didn't ask.
I don't really care either way.
All right, good.
I'm impartial.
So you seem into it, which is good. I just announced a big tour. I'm going on a comedy tour next year, hitting a bunch of cities. Well, actually, first, I'll be in San Francisco at Cobb's December 11th, 12th, and 13th.
That's my city.
That's your city. And then next year, I'm doing like 16 dates as part of a tour that I have called Fun Comfortable. And I'm hitting a ton of theater dates. And I believe the website is axs.com. We'll get you tickets to that. So please come out and see the dates. And then also, Nerdist has basically a little comedy school at Meltdown, at our showroom at Meltdown, offering classes in improv, storytelling, sketch writing. Dan Telfer is one of the people who teaches. He's one of the people who runs our social media stuff for the At Midnight Twitter account and Instagram. And anyway, go to nerdist.com/school for more info or to sign up.
I always hear them in class and they sound like they're having a great time.
And I've run into people when I go to Meltdown Comics and they, I see the joy and the hope in their eyes, these young little comedy seedlings.
Yep.
But this episode, I'm very glad, was number 600. This was Joe Rogan. This podcast mashup was long overdue. But Joe, you know what? The thing I love about Joe is he's a very funny guy, but he's also built like the thing, you know, like he's a physically powerful man, but one of like the sweetest, most well-spoken dudes.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart.
He's such a great guy. He's just a good guy.
He is.
So I'm glad that we finally were able to have him on. His new comedy special, Rocky Mountain High, is on Comedy Central this Friday, November 21st. It's on at midnight, not our show at midnight. It airs at midnight. Or it's on direct.cc.com. So watch Joe Rogan, his new comedy special, or listen to his podcast, which is very popular with the kids. It's the Nerdist episode number 600. Joe Rogan.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Finally on the podcast.
That's what I was just saying.
It took years.
It took literal
to
years
to engineer this. Years.
Hundreds and hundreds
how long
of
have been
podcasts
doing your podcast?
Came together. 5 years.
5 years. So we're four Holy and almost shit. We're almost five. We're like Holy four shit. Four and a half.
We're gonna be reaching a point where we're all gonna be like, I've been doing it for 10 years.
I know,
it's
right?
Fucking ridiculous.
I love that, dude.
Oh yeah, this is the guest book.
We'll have you
sign this later.
It's just it's a skinned Wookiee, though. It's kind of like real sad. Especially
with
on
bandolero.
Life day.
You took his
ammo.
Well, that's
this
how
is
it
a
lets
small,
you know.
This is just a small patch. Like, he could have survived this.
Not likely. Infections and what have you.
The rest of them just turned into a rug.
Isn't it funny, though, that I knew exactly what it was? Like, if it didn't have this on it, I would have no idea what it was.
Confused. Yeah.
Yeah, this the bandolier is like the essential quality of
Chewbacca. Yeah,
that you could see anything sort of like sandy haired, and you'd be like, I don't know what that. But then you put this on,
you take that off, it's an Ewok.
That's so it's really interesting how that just. Well, I mean, that doesn't even really look like the bandolier. I mean, it kind
of
does.
You know what it
not
is? It's just this visual pattern of brown, silver, brown, silver, brown, mm-hmm. and then boom, your brain goes
that's
Chewbacca.
Chewbacca. Yep, that's what he's become. This is what he's been reduced to.
Yeah, poor.
This is poor Chewbacca. He's fine.
I can't imagine Disney would ever release something so silly.
Well, you got to remember, they gave Luke a new hand, so they could probably regrow his skin.
You're probably right.
Less complicated.
Graft him a robot skin. Ooh. His bandolier's all built in now.
It was pretty great when that happened.
When Luke got his hand cut off?
When Luke got his hand cut off, you're like, how the fuck is that? And then, you know, when they finally did pay it off, they're like, oh, they just made him another hand. It's like, not a big deal at all, it turns out. He just got a robot hand.
Well, there was this guy who got attacked by a shark in Australia, and it bit his leg off, and it bit his arm off. And he was walking around talking, and he had a carbon fiber arm and a carbon fiber leg. He had no limp. I mean, his leg was from the knee down, and his arm was from the elbow down. I guess the shark just came along and just took both of them. But, I mean, he's gesturing and moving his hands around, and I was like, wow, we're not that far away.
Holy shit.
From Luke Skywalker fake hand.
Did you see the Elon Musk tweet that got deleted over the weekend?
No.
Where he was warning everyone that, like, we have to be careful with artificial intelligence because within 5 to 10 years, I think this is going to be very, very bad. Because
so you think one of the AIs
exponentially?
You think one of the AIs like deleted his tweet?
Maybe. You never know.
Well, did you ever see Transcendent Man?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The doctor from China, the professor rather from China, who was calling them Artilex, artificial intelligence. He was referring to them as Artilex, and he was saying that if it were to happen, if it does happen, like essentially you're talking about a grain of sand that has more computing power than any computer that's ever been created on Earth, and an entire being that's made out of these would be a god.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're fucked.
let's enjoy it.
Buckle
so we might not even
everybody.
Make it to 10 years of
we
podcasting.
Are fucked.
Well, Elon had a weird quote too. He had a quote called it was summoning the demon, I think is what he said.
Yeah,
that we're summoning the demon.
Can you pull the exact quote up, Katie? Look up Elon Musk deleted tweet AI. It's just going to be like AI was pretty good. Haley Joel Osment was great. No,
you know,
the other one.
when Elon Musk says shit like that, he must understand like what. How much responsibility he carries on his shoulders.
Yes.
Because he can't just, like, you and I can offhandedly say shit like that, and people are like, it's a.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
Elon Musk says it, people are like, what was that?
Yeah.
Because you're in charge of a lot of technology.
You were also in Iron Man 2 for like a second.
Yeah, for just a quick second.
I mean, he makes the first viable electric car that, like, rich people drive.
Yep. Not just Ed Begley Jr.
Yeah.
No, all of them.
Yeah. Because remember Ed Begley had that show, Something Green? What was it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The Green Planet show or something like that. Yeah,
he's
yeah.
super into recyclable, sustainable living, you know, solar power, everything. And so him driving around one of those cars was like, but now like everybody has one of those fucking Teslas.
Yeah, but Elon Musk was like, he's so fucking
he's amazing.
So smart.
He's amazing.
He is.
Which is why we should heed his advice. Everyone, turn this off immediately.
No, wait a second. Let's not be hasty.
To your bunker.
The pace of progress is artificial intelligence. I'm not referring to narrow AI. It's incredibly fast unless you have direct exposure to groups like DeepMind. You have no idea how fast. No. The risk of something seriously dangerously happening in 5 years of time frame. 10 years. The risk of something seriously dangerous happening is in the 5 year time frame. 10 years at most. But that's not a tweet. That's
Well, it was connected. It was one of those twit longer tweets. You know, one of those dealies where you go over the 140 characters.
Those are annoying.
Yep.
People are cheating with their twit longer.
I don't think they know how Twitter works if you do that. Yeah. You shouldn't, you know.
Gordon Ramsay always does that. Come on, dummy.
Come on. Trim the fat, Gordo. Trim the fat. There's too much fat in these tweets.
He's very verbose. That Gordon Ramsay.
He's got a lot to say.
A lot to say about food.
MasterChef Junior. Oh, boy. What a treat.
Wow, 5 years, Rogan. That's amazing.
Yeah, so as long as we've been doing podcasting, as long as Joe has been doing podcasting.
This thing that just.
AI is going to get us.
This thing that was just like, you know, stand-ups aren't really on television that much anymore. What do? Well, let's start talking on the internet. And now that has become the cornerstone of all of our lives.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Marin's, Kevin's, you know, like Corolla's, like all of us, like this podcast.
Ari Shaffir, Joey Diaz, Duncan Trussell. I mean, you can go down the line. There's so many people that are doing podcasts now. It's almost more are than aren't. It's rare. Bill Burr. It's rare when you meet a guy who doesn't have a podcast.
I know. And I have met, you know, and it's really funny. I met, I never get arrogant about our podcast, but there was one minute where Greg Proops was flying. We were all on a plane to a San Francisco Sketch Comedy Festival or something, and he was with Joel Murray, Bill Murray's brother. And I met him, and I was like, oh, hey, yeah, yeah, listen, if you ever want to come on the podcast sometime, he was like, oh, you got a podcast too, huh? Like, sort of like, and I was like, well, it's doing pretty well. Like, I almost got a little defensive, like, yeah, I know everyone's got a podcast, but it's not,
but
you know,
it's
like,
still like,
yeah. No, he was right.
Well, they're definitely right. Yeah, but I remember when I would tell people I had a podcast, they would go, why?
Yeah.
Yep. Like, what are you doing? And yep. I was like, ah, it's fun. And we started doing it on Ustream. It was me and my friend Brian. We just sat in front of the computer. Brian Redband is on the show all the time. We sat in front of my laptop in my living room and just answered questions on Twitter, just fucking around. It was completely non-planned. It wasn't like, I think I need a podcast. Mm-hmm. It was... I just moved back to L.A. from Colorado. I was pretty bummed out that I had to move back to L.A. My wife got pregnant, and we were up in the mountains, and it was just way too high elevation, and we had to go back to sea level. And so I was loving the mountains. It was, like, so peaceful. It was such a total, complete polar opposite of, like, being in front of large crowds and cities and all the stuff that I was used to when I was doing stand-up. I was like, wouldn't it be great if I could live in, like, the mountains and then go down? And so I thought I had it wired.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden I'm back in L.A. I'm like, shit. So I started doing this podcast thing, just fucking around. And it was like, all right, we did it 1 week. And we're like, all right, this is fun. We'll do it next Monday. We'll see you guys Monday. So then we did it next Monday. And then we did it, like, a couple weeks later. And then we started putting it up on iTunes. And then before you know it, it was like this weekly thing that is taking over my life. Yeah. Now it's like I have a big studio that's just completely dedicated to it, and I'm doing
what
three,
was in the
four
studio
a week.
Before? Did you build out the structure?
It was just a office. It's in an office park. Yeah. You know, like it's just a regular.
So you have it outside of the house. You just
I had it in my house for a while. I had it in my house for a while, and then we did it at the Ice House for a while.
Yeah.
But I wanted it to be closer to my house, so now I rent this big office space. It's essentially, it's huge. It's a warehouse, and it's got all this other jazz to it, and I just built this studio inside of it and made it kind of funky and did what I wanted to do with it. But it's now it's just, I go to work. You know, it's my spot. It's
How
weird.
How many do you put out a week?
Depends. Sometimes only two, sometimes as many as five. No more than five, I think. I think that's the most I've ever put out
in a
week.
It'd be excessive if you went up to like seven.
Yeah. Well,
just like 5 days in the work week. Because it is kind of like I know.
Carolla does like.
Five a day or something, right?
Whatever he does is ridiculous.
It's a lot.
And then he's catching contractors on Saturdays.
Yeah. How the fuck does that. And then he's doing stand up or do at least live podcasts. Like, how the fuck does he have time to do all that shit?
I think that's all he does. He does that and then like jerks off on a car. Like, that's what his life is.
Katie knows. She used to work for Adam.
Yeah, he used to work at Ace.
Yeah, they put it out every week. And we would record every day. And then we'd go up the next day.
Ah.
Oh, wow.
Still, it's where does he get that time? It's just
pretty
crazy.
It's pretty crazy. It's just sandwiched.
I don't know. Is that a great life or is that like.
Yeah, of course it is because he was doing morning radio before that. That's a morning radio is a terrible life.
That's a terrible
life. You're getting up at 3:30 every morning and you're just. Your schedule is opposite everyone else in the world.
Yeah.
And you're just tired all the time.
Yeah.
And there's so much pressure when you're doing radio to. You know, just to there's just all the corporate pressure.
You know what he should have done is moved to New York and done drive time L.A. That way you can get up at like 9.
Right.
You know?
That's smart.
Guys,
or he could just
do
a podcast
radio.
And own it all himself and not have to worry about content boundaries.
Yeah, well, not on those content boundaries, but also like the method of distribution. Like you could just kind of like just put it out any way you want now. Like our show's on Stitcher. It's on YouTube, Ustream, Vimeo, iTunes, regular MP3.
It's impossible not to get it.
It's easy to do.
There's no one can complain about not being able to download the podcast.
And you can pause.
Yes.
Like when you're listening to radio, like it would be really frustrating. I'd be listening to Stern or something like that, and some really interesting guest would come on, and I'm like, fuck, I got to go in this building. I can't listen to this.
Yeah.
I have to shut it off. And then you come back, you can't just pick up where you left off. It's gone.
And that's the worst thing, like about a work day for some reason. Whenever I like would get in the car in the morning, I'd hear the same part of Stern when I was leaving.
Right.
Like I'd catch the replay at the exact same second I got in the car in the morning. I'm like, what the fuck?
Exactly.
Stern's
right?
Sort of the Stern might.
No, here's where Sal teabags Richard again.
Stern's sort of the original podcaster in a weird sort of way.
Essentially, I mean, certainly carved the path.
Oh,
if
absolutely.
It wasn't for you know his. Really controversial style of radio, it wouldn't have opened up that medium, like the idea of that medium. Mm-hmm. It was like the initial foot through the door. Because there was always like wacky DJs. Like when I was in Boston, it was Charles Laquadera. You
know,
the morning, the big mattress. The big you know Charles Laquadera? Yes. Yeah. He's like the big mattress with Charles Laquadera. Like that's what I listened to while I was delivering newspapers. Shit. He was like the they used to have like a guy in every town would be like a big shot.
Yeah.
And now those guys are like few and far between. You got like Kevin and Bean.
Yeah.
They're still in LA. Yep. There's a couple people in like various markets, you know.
Well, when I get back, when I go back to Boston and I turn on the radio and I still hear like Lauren and Wally in the morning, I'm like,
really?
Fuck, you guys are hanging on, huh? You're doing
Maddie it. Maddie in the morning,
Maddie
too.
Maddie in the morning
he's
is still on. Yes.
He's still there.
Bob and Tom, if you're in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Bob and Tom.
Bob and Tom.
They've been
show.
Doing it for more than 30 years, right? Or something crazy like that.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very nice guys, too. And it's a great far. Have you, I'm sure you've done the show a
Few
times.
Yeah. I've only done it once. I did Bob and Tom once.
It's a real nice formula that they have. They just sort of have the structure of the show, but then they just have comics come on, and you get to just be funny, and then and that's it. But it gives them content for the show, and you promote whatever it is that you're there, you know, like every date you're trying to promote. But, yeah, they're good guys, but, you know, syndicated to a bunch of markets. But, you know, it's funny that, you know, that whole process, that whole infrastructure of, like, well, you have to get syndicated. There's only so much bandwidth. So, you know, it's like, where do you – it's very difficult to get onto radio or – you could just talk into your phone and upload it to the internet and then have it be readily available to everyone immediately.
I've done a bunch of them on planes.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah, with friends. Like I did a series podcast on a plane where we just sit there like we were flying to a gig and I put the iPhone in between the two of us and we just talk. And the fucking iPhone was fine. I mean, you hear that like the plane and the lady come over, would you guys like something to drink? Like you hear all that, you know.
But it's kind of nice because it's sort of, because I think one of the fun things about listening to a podcast is feeling like it's very immersive. Like you sort of feel like you're there and you're a part of the room. So if people have like weird room tone, then it almost, as long as it's not obtrusive, it really gives you the sense like, oh, you're sitting in the next seat. Like that person's listener has the window seat and you guys are like,
I remember like
two seats
over. I was on the road with Doug Benson and like we're in a rental car, me, him, and Graham, and all of a sudden he pulls out his iPhone is like, let's do a mini. So we do a miniature podcast in the car, and it's like, can't we just have this time to us? Well,
I know, right? But these things are actually pretty good. iPhone is actually pretty good as far as like voice recording.
Uh-huh. My only concern about recording onto the iPhone is that, you know, particularly with the latest OS, is that the phone's been crashing a lot. Like apps are crashing a lot.
Oh, reboot itself.
Fucking. Devastated.
You're crashing a lot?
I've been having a lot of crashes.
Yeah, I've been having it just reboot on me for no
reason. Reboot.
I've had that too. Yeah.
I have had that happen.
And you don't want, you know.
Right.
You just.
But you know what I would do is, I mean, whenever I do a show, I record all my shows. Mm-hmm. I did lose a show though, man. Oh.
I lost
fuck.
40.
What'd you lose?
A stand-up comedy show at the Improv. I had all this new shit I was working on, too. I was so psyched.
I lost 40 minutes in Minnesota once.
It was just
gone.
No!
It just
vanished off my phone. And I was like, after I got off stage, I was like, fuck yeah, I recorded that one. There's so much good shit in that because it was all this new stuff that I added a couple of taglines. A few things came out just on the spur on stage. I was like, ah, this is good. And then I got to my phone. I pressed save. Blip. What? Where'd it go?
Yeah.
Just gone. Gone.
There's no one to punch for that.
I had to do it, and then I got off stage. It was when we were in Minneapolis in the winter last year, and I did like 40 minutes, and then I got off the stage, and then I hit pause, and it said that I'd recorded 21 seconds.
Well, sometimes it happens if you don't blank the phone out, like you'll accidentally touch it as you're setting it down or something like that. I record, like I have a whole series of this is like the last.
Oh, look at you naming them.
I have that too. I do that too. I do the same exact thing where I name the set.
Yeah.
I don't name them. I just have a date.
I used to do that too, but then I got so confused and like there'd be times where I really needed to know what the show was.
Yeah.
You know, but you could. It's good enough.
Kids, it's good enough. If you want to do a podcast on your own, fucking grab your iPhone.
Then you absolutely could. Yeah, see, I've got, look, Helium.
Yeah. Yeah.
There it is.
Which Helium were you at?
The one in Portland.
Portland, yeah.
That's
last
amazing.
Year.
That one's amazing.
Yeah, they're good. The Heliums are good.
I heard the Heliums in Buffalo is really good, too.
I haven't been to the Buffalo one, just the Philly one.
Philly's
in Portland.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They're good guys, too, the guys who own it.
If you want to see Todd Glass, just head to Helium in Philadelphia around the holidays.
Is he always there?
Yeah, he just goes home to visit his mom, and then he just does a week of shows.
That's smart.
So first of all, your new special is on November 21st.
Yeah, this Friday night.
This Friday night. So, but in addition to that, what are the major tentpole things that you're working on besides the podcast and the special?
Well, that the special this right now I'm in this scary transitionary phase because the special's done. It's been done for 3 months. So all I've been doing for the past 3 months is writing, mm-hmm. trying to come up with new material. Because as of Friday, my act's in the toilet.
Done. You got to start all of you terrified. You can't go on the road and do that stuff anymore.
I'm terrified. So that is the primary concern right now is creating new material. But, you know, then I have obligations for the UFC. Like I was in Mexico City this weekend doing commentary for the fights. And then, you know, obviously the podcasts, and I have a sci-fi deal that I'm in the middle of trying to figure out whether or not I'm going to continue doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that's it.
Yeah. Well, that's plenty. That's a lot of shit. That's plenty of shit.
And then I obviously have wife and kids and family and that's, real life.
That's all the other time.
Don't count that.
It makes things interesting, that's for sure.
How have you found, I mean, you know, when I look at, usually when I get trolled by people, it's usually the same type of person, and that person has some configuration of a sports team on their homepage, almost always UFC, MMA, yeah. wrestling. Like, there's a certain type of guy that has hated me my entire life.
It's just Mayhem Miller hating him.
And they still... So how have you found... I mean, you know, not to disparage any kind, gentle wrestling MMA fans / MMA fans, because I know a lot of people are cool who like that stuff, but I do find it to be... It can be a particularly aggressive... verbally aggressive bunch.
Yeah.
So when you started stepping into the UFC spotlight, did you notice that right away? Like, hey, what the fuck, guys? Come on.
Well, fortunately, I started doing it before social media was even existed.
So you were grandfathered in the cool club already.
I started in 97. That's when I did the first post-fight interviews for the UFC.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then I became the commentator in 2002. So it's been 12 years of being the guy explaining what's happening. And I'm like, for kids that are 22, I was, you know, they were 10 when they used to listen to me. So it's like, it's a part of, I'm a part of the whole thing.
When did news radio end?
99.
Oh, so you started UFC during news radio.
Yes. Yeah. And it was like, when I would tell people about it, this is when the UFC was, nobody knew what it was. Yeah. It was like I was doing porn. I was going off to do like
underground kind of a thing.
Pitbull porn in a cage, you know, right. That's what it was like. It was just, it was like, why are you doing that? Like, that's going to ruin your life. And I was like, I don't know. I like it. It was a bizarre thing to be a part of. And now that it's become actually like a mainstream sport, I'm kind of vindicated, but it could have easily just been some disaster.
Well, you know, the important thing though is that as long as you continue to make choices for things that are fun for you, that's the best, you know, it's like doing a podcast.
Yeah.
That also could have been like basement porn to some people. It's, what are you doing? You know, but well, now
it kind of was too. I mean, when I first started podcasting, like the why thing was joking around, but not really. Like, people were really saying like, why are you doing that? You're talking about all this crazy shit,
right?
And you're just putting it up on the internet for people to get for free. Like, what the fuck is wrong
with
you? My
favorite was like, well, then why not just do a radio show? Like,
yes.
Oh yeah, that's the easy way to go.
Yeah. Well, just get somebody to pay me. Jeez, what am I doing?
Do a radio show.
You know how hard it is to get a morning gig, like a radio gig or an afternoon gig? And even so, you're gonna have to play music and all that other shit and deal with bosses, and they're going to give you guidelines as to what to be discussed and not, and just, you know.
News radio, by the way, was just one of those, it's such a special show that just, I mean, I remember that was one of those shows that was funny from the first episode. Like, it didn't necessarily have to find, like, it was just a super weird, quirky, funny show, like, right off the bat. And everyone had a really strong character right off the bat. And I miss that show. I really do miss that show.
We're doing some reunion at Sketchfest in San Francisco in January. It's going to be really interesting.
Oh, that's
we're going to
awesome.
All get together and talk and go on stage and have a weird thing with it. It's like we're going to wind up crying.
Oh my God, that's going to be amazing, though.
Yeah, we were at Phil's. Phil just got a Hollywood Walk of Fame thing.
Just now? It took that long?
Yeah, believe it or not. And we were there the other day, and it was Paul Sims and Josh Leib and Joe Fury and the writers and producers and Stephen Root and Candy Alexander were there. And we were the only actors that were there, but it was just so strange. So strange to think, like, wow, that was 20 years ago, guys. You know, we started in 1994.
Tubalcane was 20 years ago.
I remember. Oh, well, this is how long. This is. Fuck. this dates me by using news radio as the carbon dating method. I remember watching, I think the first episode of news radio I saw was while Jenny McCarthy and I were at Lake Havasu for doing the spring break to do the first two episodes of Singled Out.
Wow.
It was the first time I saw, because that was 94. That was 94. And and that's when I first saw news radio.
Wow.
And of course, you know, I loved Foley. I mean, I was the hugest Kids in the Hall fan, and of course, Phil, but you know, that I have a very vivid memory of being at spring break and watching fucking news radio at night.
I mean, it was so good that it kind of shied me away from ever doing any sitcoms ever again.
Yeah.
I just, and when news radio came along, I had a development deal to do my own show, and they were sitting me down with writers and all this, and I got a chance to see the pilot. Like, the pilot was somebody else. It was Ray Romano. He got fired, and they brought in some new guy for the pilot, and then they fired him. And then they showed me the pilot, and, you know, they're like, do you still want to do your own show? And I was like, no. I'm like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
So I wound up auditioning for it, and I wound up getting that. And then after it was over, I had a bunch of really bad script sent my way and really bad ideas and then met with some people, and it seemed so gross. I was like, oh no, I went to the promised land too early. Now I'm fucked. I can't go to just do a shitty sitcom afterwards, because I would be living in hell.
Yeah. You peaked.
And so I wound up, that's one of the core reasons other than money that I chose to do Fear Factor.
Oh wow!
Because I was like, I just don't want to do it. I can't. I don't want to work with actors. I don't want to. I don't want to do any of that.
I think I auditioned for Fear Factor. There was this was and not in a disrespectful way, but you were sort of the name that my manager and I would joke about whenever. When the longest time I would audition before I actually started getting hired, I went through a bad period, Joe, I went this period where I would get really close and test for something, and then we would sort of joke like, well, you know, they're just going to offer it to Joe Rogan, right? and then you'd swoop in and get for the longest time, it was like, God damn it, Rogan. You know,
Chris was so close to calling the early UFC matches.
That was never in danger of happening. There were so many shows that I almost got when I look back now where I'm like, I don't know if I would have done a good job at that show. Like, I don't know if I would have done a good job at Fear Factor. And the other one was Wipeout. I almost got Wipeout and I didn't get it.
Did Same they end guys. Up giving it to John Henson?
They gave it to
you?
John Henson.
You were going
yeah.
to that spot?
Yeah, they gave it to John Henson.
Yeah, they offered me that too. It was the same guys, who did Fear Factor, but it was tricky because that was a green screen thing.
Yeah.
You weren't really going on. You had to do it after the fact. So it was it would have fucked up my quote, you know, in terms of the business, you know, but it was same guys.
Now, so I don't remember how they dealt with this, but just going back to news radio for a sec. But so Phil died during news radio.
Yeah, Phil died in between seasons 4 and season 5.
That was in 98. I remember he was in 98. So how did the show deal with that?
John Lovitz came on.
Oh, John Lovitz came on. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, John. We had a a funeral for Phil on the show, or a goodbye episode.
That was brutal. Yeah, Bill. They did a funeral for Bill.
It's hard to talk. I'll start crying if I really start thinking about it.
Well, do you? So you think when you do this reunion, are you nervous about it a little bit in San Francisco?
We'll cry. Yeah, it's inevitable.
It is what it is. I mean, it is what it is. Just fucking sucks.
Yeah, there's just no. You know, I mean, I'm tearing up right now. There's no way around it.
That just speaks to how fucking awesome Phil Hartman must have been to be around. This 20 years later, you're still, well, this is now what? This is almost 15.
It was, everything was awful. The whole, everything about it was awful. You know, the fact that his kids were in the house, that was awful. His wife killed him and then killed herself, that was awful. You know, it was just, it was something that you never thought could happen to someone you know. You know, you would thought I mean, people die, they get old, they get sick, but no one's going to murder anybody that you know, especially not the two people that you know. Like, I knew both of them. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, it opened my eyes up though. It opened my eyes up to the actual real dangers of bad relationships. Like, I always thought of bad relationships as just oh, you fight, but you know, that's unfortunate, but hey, it is what it is. They're always yelling at each other, but what are you going to do? I never thought I would know two people that wound up actually killing each other. Like, I never thought that that would be possible.
Well, bad relationships and also drugs and addiction. And
Zoloft as well. Zoloft and drugs together, which creates some sort of a psychotic effect, apparently. But I know that there was a settlement. There was a settlement with Zoloft that apparently the kids got or somebody got. You know, I don't know. But there was a lot of issues. She was a mess. I mean, obviously, but without the drugs, without the Zoloft, she was a mess. She was like a failed actress who like deeply resented his success. And as he became more and more successful, their relationship became more and more contentious. And it was just like she would embarrass him and insult him publicly. It was ugly. They had ugly, ugly falling out sort of fights. And they would break up, and he would go live on – he had a boat, like a little sailboat. He would go live on a sailboat. I think it was a sail, some sort of a boat. And then he would come back, and you know, they would make up. And
you just hope that – I mean, for a guy who was legitimately one of the funniest people in comedy.
Yeah.
And so many people – you know, and I've said this before about, you know, about Robin and just – like it's so heartbreaking to me that some of the people who bring the most joy to the world can never—they just never are able to connect to that, or they have such, you know, horrible circumstances that don't allow them to really, you know, even kind of appreciate the fact that they make so many people so happy.
Yeah. Even if he did appreciate, you know, the more I've grown to understand clinical depression and having friends that are depressed or friends that have gone through depression, that have sought treatment, it's like, it is as much of a disease as cancer. It's as much of a and it's a marginalized sort of a disease where people have this like, oh, just suck it up attitude. But there's something going on in some people's brains, man. And it's just, it is what it is. And some people don't, they just don't ever recover from whatever it is. And they wind up taking their own life. And for Robin Williams, one of the things, I have a good friend who's an endocrinologist and he specializes in traumatic brain injuries. And he has written a paper on the correlations between heart surgery and depression and suicide, in fact.
Wow.
That apparently what happens whenever you undergo like a very serious surgery, like heart surgery where, you know, they have to stop your heart and cut you open and you're under anesthesia for prolonged periods of time, apparently there's some significant hormonal deficiencies after it's over. Your body is just in shock, and it can affect the way your body produces hormones and serotonin and dopamine and growth hormone and testosterone and all sorts of different things. And it can lead people to be just unbelievably depressed, just devastated. They feel like they can't get through life. Mm-hmm. And Robin went through open heart surgery in 2009. And he has, you know, this theory that was sort of like the beginning of the end for him. Hmm. And then it just started off this downward spiral.
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, I just wish, because obviously there's nothing really you can tell someone, especially if they're going through something. You can't just go, hey, you know, because when someone is really, really, you just feel helpless.
Helpless.
And you just feel like, I want to help you, and I don't know what to do. So I think, you know, I think if we're going to try to raise awareness for depression in our society, one of the things that we should do is to, you know, how to help someone cope with it if you're someone very in their inner circle.
Like, yeah.
How do you help them? What can you do? You know, because obviously the what is intuitive is like, hey, snap out of it. Like, it's not really helpful.
Doesn't do a damn thing. I had a friend who was on the verge of suicide, and he confided in me, and he confided in several of us, and, you know, he's hiding it for a while and didn't want to talk about it. And then, you know, he had this breakdown moment, and I said, listen, let me make a call, because I know a guy who had a good friend that went through a similar situation. I'll see what I can do. And I connected him with a psychiatrist, and he got on some pills, and boom, pulled right out of it. It's like he was like on the door, like on the suicide door. And now he's doing great.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, he's so happy.
Wow.
He's so different. It was just like his brain. And here's what's really fascinating. It was directly connected to him using Propecia. Propecia, and this is another thing that a paper that my friend, the endocrinologist, sent me. Yes, the hair pill is directly...
It's really a prostate pill.
Yes.
Well, Scott's originally gets to the top of my head.
Called
guys.
Proscar. I was on it, too. It kills your dick like a fucking bullet.
It does?
Yeah, killed mine, yeah.
No, did it? Did you recover from it?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Snapped right back. This is how I found out.
My dick's
out.
Fine, guys.
Well, everybody has their own standards. I didn't realize there was anything wrong with me until I ran out of it. And I was like, oh, I got to get my prescription refilled. And all of a sudden, like, I'm like, why do I have hard-ons all the time? Like, what the fuck is going on? And then I realized, like, oh, I was probably like, poisoning myself. And my friend got on it. And right away, like, that's when the depression started. Mm. And for some people, you know, it's not everybody. A lot of people get through it like you, and they have no problems with it at all. But then other, it's just, it inhibits dihydrotestosterone, and that's what causes hair loss. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, you can cause a cascade of different events inside your body or not because of, you know, there's a lot of biodiversity in human beings.
There's also a reason that you should think twice about putting something into your body that they caution pregnant women not to touch.
Don't touch it. Not eat it.
Don't touch it.
Because of the DHT?
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, because of, you know, the
it'll get into the pores and then
what it does to inhibit DHT can have an adverse effect on the fetus. Very, very dangerous for pregnant women.
Jesus.
So is cat shit, by the way.
Oh.
Women are not supposed to go anywhere near litter boxes because of something called toxoplasma. Toxoplasmosis. Toxoplasma is a cat parasite that infects rats, and it changes the sexual drive of rats and gets rats to be attracted to cat piss to the point where it literally causes their testes to swell, causes them to be sexually aroused, and reduces their fear of cats to be like non-existent. So instead of being terrified of cats, they're actually attracted to cats.
Super turned on to cats.
And then cats eat them, kill them, and then cats get this cat parasite, which apparently doesn't affect the behavior of cats that much, but it gets into humans. And it affects humans because of livestock grazing.
Is this why I've been fucking all those cats?
Could be.
Okay.
But like the crazy cat lady thing, mm-hmm. like that's real. Toxoplasmosis affects 60% of Brazil, something around 60 million Americans have it. And it also has a direct relationship to successful soccer teams.
Because what?
Yes.
What sort of Freakonomics are we in now?
Because it makes men more aggressive. It makes men more aggressive, more sexually charged, apparently. And it may, in fact, even make women more submissive. And this cat parasite has also – there's a guy named Robert Sapolsky. He's a professor at Stanford, and he's like studied this like for years, and he's got all these really fascinating lectures online.
That's amazing. So the next time I get all caps trolled by someone, I can just write back like –
toxoplasma much?
If you have a cat, you need to get rid of it. Is it something that people, like if they get rid of the cat and they're not around anymore, does it diminish in their system?
You have it. When you have it, you have it. It's just a part of your body now.
Oh, and how is it transmittable?
It's transmittable. I think like if you like probably like blood or maybe shit or something like that because it's, sounds you know,
that's a way.
It's a parasite.
Wait a minute, guys.
It'd probably have to be some way for it to get into your body. It'd probably, you know, it'd probably be difficult but transmittable.
You know what this means is that with all the popularity of cat videos and Instagram on,
yes.
It means the internet has toxoplasmosis.
Could be. Yeah.
That's what's going on. That's why.
Is that why the internet's balls are swelling?
Yes. Well, that's why people are so fascinated with cats.
One of the things Sapolsky found was that there's also a direct correlation between motorcycle accidents and because it makes people reckless. So they would get these motorcycle accidents in and they would say, test the guy for toxo. And they would test him for toxo. And he said a disproportionate amount of these motorcycle accidents were caused by people who had toxoplasmosis infections.
That's incredible.
Incredible. So it would make them wild. Like,
the real moral of the story is get a fucking dog.
Get a dog.
I have two cats already and another one on the way. And one of my cats was feral. You know, I had a feral cat from the time I was like a little baby. My friend, she found this like a near her apartment building. It's like a long time ago. Found this cat who had gotten kittens, and they sort of captured all of them, and you know, tried to hand them out to people. And I'm a big sucker for strays, sure. So I took this fucking crazy cat into my house.
Never came around, or did he?
Oh, he was crazy. He would let me touch him and pet him, and he would like purr when everybody else was like. Anybody came near him.
If you've never actually encountered a feral cat, it's the sounds they make are genuinely fucking terrifying.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That hit you on a level where you go, I'm not supposed to go near that thing. Like it's that weird. Yeah. Like they do this like popping hiss sound. Yeah.
That's the sound of the claws coming out.
It's fucking violent, man.
Snicked.
Yeah, exactly.
So you stopped taking
the greatest noise.
Did you go back in the Propecia after that?
No, I just fucking shaved my head.
Yeah,
that's the way.
But I quit the Propecia long before I shaved my head.
But you have a good head shape, though.
Thank you.
So you can
shave. I'm lucky. Fortunate.
I got divots.
Some people, I have some scars, but some people have like a flat back to the head, which is very odd. Like they have a, it goes
oh,
like
they
this,
were like
it
babies that were laid on their back for
maybe.
Too long.
I think maybe my head's a little flat in the back, actually. I don't think I would look good with a shaved head. I think I would look good.
I looked like a fucking golf ball when I shaved my head. It was so bad.
It was so freeing.
Little
though.
Pockets of like, because I couldn't get into the pockets of divots that I for some reason have in my head. So it was just like a little patchy, like I was
weird.
A Barbie doll that a kid cut the hair off of.
Because you couldn't get
in there.
Well, you can get some nair.
Yeah, just like.
Which is probably also super bad for you.
Probably not good to put in your head. Good to put in your head. But you said it was freeing to shave your head.
Oh, yeah, just not to think about it. No shampoo anymore. Oh, never worry
nice.
About it.
Because nice.
Like, it can't fall out anymore. Like, nope. It's like, that's gone.
Do your worst, guys.
But you can still get head cancer, I guess. You're walking around, you know, skin could get cancer.
You got a hat on, so you're fine.
Yes. Well, it's not even light in here.
When did you get super ripped? What period of time was that? Because Joe Rogan from News Radio was just like a regular size guy.
Joe Rogan from News Radio.
That was like
cut.
One of the things I was always having to take my shirt off for weird reasons.
Yeah.
Well, I was.
not for weird reasons, just because
I didn't really
see.
Lift weights much back then, though. It was just kickboxing. So I was like leaner. And then I started getting into jiu-jitsu in like 96, 97. And then, like, somewhere around then, I started really lifting weights because I was tired of getting my ass kicked. Like, that was the thing. The thing about jiu-jitsu also is you're trying to protect your joints just with armor because I became fascinated by this martial art that involved, like, the goal of it is to break your limbs. Like, you obviously tap out in class so you never get broken. But, but I've had, you know, 3 knee surgeries, my nose fixed, my back got fucked up. I mean, you get a lot of like weird, crazy injuries from jiu-jitsu. So I started lifting a lot of weights.
Just as like body armor?
Yeah, a lot of ways just to make you more effective in jiu-jitsu and to protect you. Because, you know, if you're thin and you don't have like a lot of muscle, like for kickboxing, it was all just about speed and movement. And like the more, if you put a lot of muscle on it, actually wouldn't help you that much. So when I was training in that, it didn't really make me much bigger. You know, I mostly did like body weight exercise. I did like a little bit of weights every now and then, but then I got really into it, like right around the top, but I got into jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. And did that change? Do you still fight jiu-jitsu?
No, well, I still train, you know, but I mean, I don't fight. I don't like.
You don't ever want to be in a fight.
I was going to fight Wesley Snipes. Because they offered me some ridiculous amount of money to fight Wesley Snipes.
Because
Wesley Snipes had all these tax problems.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that was going to help him out of the tax problems?
No. I mean, maybe.
Create more tax problems for him?
Or going to give him some money.
Oh, they were going to make him fight and then go
like.
No,
it was his idea.
Oh.
I think he probably was indulging in some. What's the best way to describe it? Some things that would affect your judgment.
Some possible
stimulants from South
America. I mean,
who knows?
Could be anything. Yeah. A lot of coffee.
Could be.
Too much coffee.
Makes you very sniffly.
Toxo.
Could be that bean that goes through the road and shit. And that's the most expensive coffee in the world.
So that was like 6 or 7 years ago before they locked him up. And I got a call from one of the guys who's the original producer of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. He goes, okay. I've got a crazy offer for you. And then he came to me with this Wesley Snipes thing, but it was just some stupid amount of money. And I was like, and then I looked up and he had never done any jiu-jitsu before. He didn't have any experience in jiu-jitsu. I was like, I'm going to strangle this guy. Like, I guess he just maybe is hoping that that won't happen. But I was like, if I get a hold of him, I'm going to fucking.
Was there a point where you said, yes, I'll do this?
I said right away. Yeah. I said, yeah.
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 And then why did it never happen?
He changed his mind.
Of course.
Yeah. I think.
He didn't think he'd say yes.
Well, I said yes, and then he changed the, like, it was going to be like a 50-50 split of the money. And then he wanted more than me, and I said, fine. I go, look, just give me this amount, and we're good. I don't give a fuck what you give him. Mm-hmm. Just let's do this. And then, like, it went back and forth, lawyers involved, contract negotiations, the whole deal. It went back and forth for, I hired this guy, Rob Kamen, who's like a famous world championship kickboxer, trained me, and I was working out with him every day, and I was doing jiu-jitsu at night. It was brutal. It was really hard. I was always tired. I went through it for like 4 months. I got in incredible shape, but I was preparing for this, and then finally he just backed out of it completely.
Oh.
And then he went to jail.
Yeah.
So he was involved in this strange movement, apparently, where, you know, he got wrapped up with some guy who had him convinced that taxes were unconstitutional. That I guarantee you
that happens.
Well, yeah, it does, man. Yeah. Well, the rub is, here's what the rub is. The supposedly, when income tax, when federal income tax came into play, it was supposed to be only be in the time of war. Like, and then once war was done, we were supposed to go back to not paying federal income tax the way, you know, we have to today. And so apparently it's written that way somewhere. And they were arguing that taxes were unconstitutional. And they just said, yeah, fuck you. You're going to jail, dummy. And it wasn't even a matter of paying. They wouldn't even just let them pay, which is really fascinating about taxes. Because tax is the only, like, if you owed $1 million in credit card debt, you would have to pay that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would say, okay, here's a payment plan. You got to pay us X amount a week, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, you pay it. But taxes, if you try to cheat them on taxes, they make an example out of you. And it's some really creepy thug shit. You know, it's some really creepy, like, in a ways, it's kind of some mob shit. They're like, look, it doesn't matter if you pay us. You're going to pay us. But we're also going to lock you in a cage. So well, we let other people.
Are you left-handed or right-handed?
Other famous people are going to know.
There was a friend of my family's who, and it was an older person. 1 year, she just came into some money and just didn't pay the taxes the way she was supposed to. Totally her fault, but she just didn't know any better.
Right.
And so they came after her, like, you know, so it was like when the tax bill came, she was just not, you know, unfortunately, she was just not great with money. And so when the tax bill, she couldn't pay it. And so it was just like years and years, like, had paid back the original amount years before, but was basically just paying all the interest because she couldn't pay it off all at once.
Oh,
and it was just like all this interest just tacking on and tacking on and tacking on and tacking on. It was like, yeah, that's some fucked up mob shit. Like,
it
some
is.
Real fucked up mob shit.
They put Lauryn Hill in jail.
Yeah.
Lauryn Hill from the Fugees.
What?
Yes.
Yeah.
She was in jail for like a year.
She was in actual jail.
Right?
Yeah,
wasn't she in jail for a year?
How does that make you pay your taxes faster?
It doesn't.
It's like debtor's prison.
That's the beauty of it. They don't want you to have to pay your taxes faster. They just want everyone else to know that if you do this, we will throw you in jail.
Yeah. We're going to take someone who's completely safe, nonviolent, and we're going to pretend they're fucking dangerous. And we're going to lock them in a cage. Lauryn Hill, beautiful voice.
Yeah.
Amazing artist.
Maybe the problem was that was the only defense. Beautiful voice, guys.
Your Honor,
huh?
She has a beautiful voice.
Sing the
lawyer
character. I pro bono, no one would take her, so I volunteered.
Lauryn, sing, come on, one time.
That's the other thing. I mean, think about how much money she must have. She probably could have easily paid it off.
I mean,
she's not broke.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think Wesley Snipes went broke. I mean, he lost all his money. He got a bad reputation after. I mean, Patton Oswalt has famously done that whole bit about him in Blade.
Yeah, Blade 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Patton worked on Blade 3. So he has this whole bit about doing Blade 3 with the new cool Blade guy who is replacing Wesley Snipes because Wesley Snipes was on coke and freaked out. And so he has this whole, like, routine about how crazy Wesley Snipes was. I mean, it was pretty clearly established. And so he lost all his money. He went through all of his money. He didn't have any money to pay them. And then on top of that, they just locked him in fucking jail.
Oh, my God.
Now, is your fight philosophy, because I've worked with just like physical trainers before who I've had pretty much the same guy training for like 9 years.
And he's great. Tom Dieters.
Yes.
Look him up on the internet.
As well. And for a while, boxing was part of the regimen, which was really fun. And he was a kickboxer, but he was always very much like, you know, you never want to be in a fight. It's the last resort. Don't like, if you don't have to, like, don't get in a fight.
Tom is a national taekwondo champion.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Tom will fuck you up if he wants to.
Yeah, so that's good advice.
What is your philosophy?
That's like, the best advice.
Because you obviously, you could mess most people up in the world, but would your choice be if someone's squaring off, to be like, you know what, dude?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah, get away from it. Don't fight with dogs either. Don't get in a fight with a chimp. Don't let a giraffe kick you.
No, but Your Honor, I could take this chimp. If you let me take this chimp, Your Honor.
Don't ever get in a situation where you might get hurt. If you could somehow or another get out of it, I mean, why wouldn't you get out of it? Because your ego, right? Because you want to say, like, fuck this guy. I'll show this guy what I can do to him. Then no, don't do that. Because first of all, if you kick someone's ass, it's never the end of it. People don't like their asses kicked. Mm-hmm. So they will come back and they'll fucking stab you or shoot you or hit you when you're not looking.
Or like you could really injure someone.
Yes.
And then that's a whole other set of problems.
I have a friend who was a bouncer in a bar in Long Island, and the guy that he worked with got in a bar fight with this guy as he was working as a bouncer, hit the guy. The guy got knocked out, fell back, and hit his head and died.
Oh.
And the guy wound up going to jail, and it haunted him for the rest of his life. I mean, he was responsible for some drunk guy who could easily have probably been one of his friends or something if the circumstances were different. And now this guy's dead because he made a poor choice, and he got drunk at a bar, and the guy made a poor choice and hit him, and, you know, it's a big giant disaster. So yeah, my philosophy is don't fight anybody.
Fortunately, yeah. I've had that ingrained on me my entire life because I was never able to do that.
Chris doesn't have a fight philosophy so much as a flight philosophy.
Yeah, a flight philosophy.
It's a good thing to have.
That is only first class. Window, please.
Yes, window seats.
Yes to the mimosa.
Well, I always, you know, for me, when I was very small in grade school, it wasn't until high school that I even sprouted past 5 feet. That, you know, for me, it was, and I'm sure a lot of comics probably have the same thing, is just talking my way out of things.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have any other tool set at my disposal. So it was always like trying to reason with people and try to make jokes or get out of it, you know.
Yeah.
It was never the, no, fuck you. Like, that was never my.
I was not much of a. I was very socially awkward when I was young. I was not much of a talker. I didn't even think about comedy until deep into my martial arts competition days. I was a U.S. Open Taekwondo champion. I won the Massachusetts State Championship like 4 years in a row. And the only reason why I got into comedy is because I made people in the locker room laugh.
That's Henny Youngman's origin story, too. Some of the Catskills, just but beating people.
I wasn't funny in high school. I mean, I had like a couple funny things that happened. Newton South, Newton,
all right,
Massachusetts.
Newton kid, whatever.
Yeah, I wasn't funny at all. I mean, I would do funny cartoons. I was I wanted to be a comic book illustrator, so I would draw like a lot of, like, I would draw, like, my teacher was like super into Jane Goodall, so I'd do my teacher having sex with this kid who was always kissing her ass, and she was screaming out, "Do me monkey style," like Jane would have. Like, I would always draw like cartoons involving the teacher. Like, there was a guy named Mr. White. He was like 5'2", so every time I drew him standing on a box or standing on a chair. Like, everything he did, it was standing on top of something. Like, it was like this little inside joke between me and all my friends, and everybody thought it was funny. Like, that's how I got my funny out. I would draw like cartoons, but like verbally, I was super nervous. Like, I wasn't good at talking. Like, I would like go to a bank teller if I had it. Like, I was like scared. Oh, wow. Like, I was going to get up in the front of the line. I was like, oh, I'm going to have to talk soon. Here we go. I'm going to have to talk soon. Oh, shit. Which is bizarre that I wound up making a living talking.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I
and
got over it.
You speak quite well, too. So
got
it's
over
not,
it.
It's not just that you can talk to people. Like,
but
you,
he's still fucking terrified of banks.
Still, I'm going to talk to the teller.
Oh, God.
Oh, I'm so glad ATMs are here.
I like to deposit. Yeah, this is a robbery. Oh, God, I did it again.
I didn't mean to do this.
ATMs saved my life. Just the fact that I don't have to go to the line and get to the front and talk to somebody. But so I was not like a good talker. I was not like smooth or eloquent. And I didn't talk my way out of situations. I was competing all throughout high school. I was fighting like from the time I was like 15 on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's all I did. I barely paid attention in high school.
Well, so then what made you think, oh, I could go be an actor. I could go be a comic.
I never thought I could be an actor. That's totally accidental. That happened. I got a development deal when I was on MTV. I owe everything, like literally everything, to two friends. One of them is still one of my best friends. Steve Graham, who was an ophthalmologist at the time, and he's still a doctor in Arizona, and we would train together, and I was like a teenager, and he was a grown man. He's about 15 years older than me, and he was the one who like kind of just grabbed me by my shoulders, said, "You're really funny. Like, you could be a comedian. Like, you like, I would do impressions of like my instructor having sex with people and like, you know, using his accent, and I'd do impressions of different people that we knew. But I was just trying to make everybody laugh. I wanted attention, and I would make them laugh because I was comfortable talking to them because they were my friends. But I didn't think that I would ever be like, I never had aspirations to go on stage. I was always a huge fan of stand-up comedy, but it wasn't even on the list of potential career choices. I had no aspirations. And then my friend Steve like literally told me, "You should be a comedian."
So where'd you start? In Boston or?
Boston. Yeah. Stitches open mic night.
Wow.
August 27th, 1988.
Oh, there was still a pretty, I mean,
well, that was still a catch was still open. Right.
That was a good time for comedy.
As good as it gets. There was I literally came in the door right at the right moment. And when I was leaving Boston, which was like 90, 91-ish, when I was leaving, it was all falling apart. Like I came in, I rode the last
wave.
Right
on the edge of like Cross and mm-hmm.
They were there
John
a little
Ennis
bit before me. Louis was there.
Yeah.
Marin was there. Those guys were already like established. Yeah. Nick DiPaolo, mm-hmm. Anthony Clark. They were all established, and I rode the wave. And then Burr came behind me, and Patrice came behind me. They were like right after me. But I got out right when it was ending, right when, and now Boston is just like, it's a shell of what it used to
be.
Oh,
God, I know. I was there, and when I was in college, it was like 2001, and there's like, there was nothing.
It's
and
crazy.
Then the Comedy Connection closed, and then
yes.
I was like, what the fuck?
And now it's just a theater,
yeah,
the,
now
Wilbur
you go to the
Wilbur.
The Wilbur. Yeah.
Wilbur's great, though.
It's a great play,
listen.
But
we've done it, we love it. We'll
no
go back.
Open mic nights.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to, when I was there, there was 5 comedy clubs on one block.
Oh, my God.
And then there was another one down the street. There was Dick Daugherty's Comedy Vault, which was down the street. And then there was Nick's Comedy Stop. And then down the street was the original Comedy Connection, which was a small room. Like, maybe you could shove 150 people in there. But, I mean, you were really packing it in. Then above it was the Comedy Club at the Charles Playhouse. And then across the street was Duck Soup. And then they were doing something.
Wow,
you remember
yeah.
Duck Soup?
Duck Soup.
And then they were doing something above Duck Soup. And what Duck Soup was the guys who owned the Comedy Connection, they had this play to make a really super high-end comedy club. So they spent a shitload of money. And then as they were spending this money, the scene just started dying. It just like started falling out. And it was almost an oversaturation issue because there was Evening at the Improv and Caroline's Comedy Hour. And there was just so much fucking comedy on
TV.
Yeah,
by 92, comedy was like, had been imploded.
They just,
the bubble burst.
They just went crazy.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys figured out how to talk like a comedian.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily comedy. I'm looking at my dog and I'm like, you tell me. And there was this thing. Like, yes. I mean, I remember the first time I went on stage, I dressed like a comedian. I had a blazer on. I've never worn a blazer in my life. I rolled my sleeves up. I had like a wacky t-shirt on and I had like a funny pin or something like that. Like a
the uniform, you
know?
The
yeah, the
comedian.
Uniform, and then sneakers with jeans, you know. And I was trying to look like what I saw on Evening at the Improv, and you know, trying to talk like those guys. And that's what a lot of people did. And some people, they made like a career doing Wayne Cotter. They made like a career doing that for like a long time. They did that sort of comedy.
Wow. It almost never works, by the way.
No,
when someone makes the super nice comedy club, because there's something about a comedy club that should be a little bit dirty, like a little gritty and a little, this is subversive, we shouldn't be here, like something that makes it. But whenever they do, whenever they start making like nice dinner theater where they logically go,
yes,
you know what comedy needs? Nice seats, really good food, like a night. It just almost never works.
Especially in Boston.
Yeah.
In Boston's
have
a
you been
grimy
to the new
fucking
club there?
Town.
Laugh Boston?
No,
have
I haven't.
I haven't yet either. I wonder.
I heard the
is.
Sound system sucks. That's what I keep hearing.
You know what?
I heard it's fun.
Get the sound system together,
go back
guys.
And do
yeah.
It.
Go well, they get mad when you talk about the
you
sound
know,
system.
If you go out, the problem with Laugh Boston is that it's like out. It's like out in like south, like over by where the like floating hospital is. It's like out over there. So it's like there's no foot traffic. You're gonna just be playing to people in the hotel.
Oh, gotcha.
Well, Katie, what time is that? Like
the theater district. The theater district. Like Nick's Comedy Stop's still there, right? Sort of. Still there.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
They still book it on the weekends and everything?
Yep, you're absolutely correct.
They used to do three shows simultaneously. They would have guys, they would do the upstairs room, and then they would have a downstairs room, and then they had a dance club that they had converted to a comedy club. So they had like a small room downstairs, and they had the big room upstairs, and then they had this dance club. This fucking high ceilings, was a terrible room, but they was just, they couldn't get enough people in there. It's like, that's what people wanted to do on the weekends. That's insane. They wanted to go to the comedy club. And then played against Sam's.
I don't know if anyone can answer this, but is the Kowloon on Route 1, does that still have there. The comedy club in it?
I think it does, because I saw someone who's a friend of mine from Boston had a tweet about going to the Kowloon, so I'm pretty sure the Kowloon's still there.
Because when I was a kid, I used to remember like seeing like Gilbert coming through there, Saget would come through there.
What about Giggles and Saugus on Route 1? Is that still there as well?
That can't still be there.
That's Mike Clark's room, Lenny Clark's brother.
I don't know.
That guy.
Google it.
Yeah.
Find out.
Giggles in Saugus on Route 1.
That, by the way,
it's a little
sounds
past
like
the Square One Mall.
If you were making fun of it, you're like, hey, this guy's going to be at Giggles in Saugus over here. Like,
it's great gig. That was a great gig. I mean, I got to see everybody perform at
that
gig.
Laugh Boston, if you want to have me out, I'll come by.
Oh, well, you system. Threw it out there.
Promote it on the podcast. As long as you can promote.
Oh, sure,
you'll get, you can get
thrilled.
Booked at pretty much any comedy club if you're like, hey, if you can promote it, great.
Yeah, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
I would imagine you're doing theaters mainly now.
I do, but you know what? I did my last comedy special in a club.
Still there?
It's still there. Giggles and Saugus.
Wow. Nice.
I did my last comedy special at the Denver Comedy Works. And
the downstairs one?
Yeah,
downtown,
yeah,
Lambert Square?
Yeah.
Fucking great club.
Yeah, it's best.
One of the best.
And because of that, I did like a whole series of clubs leading up to that. And I liked it so much. Like, even though I make more money doing theaters, I mean, I'm doing a few theaters. Like, I got like the Celebrity Theater next month in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. That's that crazy theater in the Round where Louis did his last HBO special. I'm doing that.
Go see Joe doing all new hour.
Yeah. Luckily, I've been writing, so fucking still terrified. But like this weekend, I'm doing the Improv in Ontario. I still do.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I still do clubs.
Are you? How much into this new set are you at this point?
Well, I have a lot of extra material that I didn't put on the special that I can
always fall back
on.
That's great.
I always keep like what I call like pillars, and then, you know, and then I'll build walls and put stuff around it. But I'm always, there's always pillars that I could, if I'm in a fucking panic, I can fall back on those. But it's really all about like, the way I feel about premises is that premises are kind of like scaffolding, you know, and then once you have the scaffolding, then you just sort of like figure out a way to make it funny and add all this to it and you know, eventually lay a carpet down and have it nice and finished. But like there's a friend who's a good comic who is a fairly new guy, and he was doing this bit, and I was like, listen, man, that's a really funny bit, but it's a tired premise. Like, too many people have done that. Almost, you've got your own jokes. I go, you've got to think of the creativity that you're putting into this premise. It's like the premise is scaffolding. All the stuff that you're putting around it is what's unique. Just figure out a way to do a completely unusual or unique premise and not have – it was just too tired. I'd seen too many guys do the same bit. I mean, even though his was his, it was just essentially not parallel thinking as much as like an obvious premise.
Right.
But I was like, there's a certain point in time you got to realize that what the subject matter is essentially the scaffolding. And then all the other stuff that goes around it is, you know, that's where all the work goes in. Don't put any work into a shitty building, you know?
That's like, really interesting.
It's not worth it.
Yeah, but if you're a new comic, if you're a newer comic, you may not. I mean, it's helpful. Yeah. It's helpful to have someone go, hey, do this.
Yes.
You know, like,
yes.
Fortunately, the way that you normally learn that and the reason why it takes so long to develop as a stand-up is because you just got to do it so much, and then you start realizing like, oh, that's something. Mm-hmm. Oh, like a lot of those lessons you learn on your own. And so the guy was very lucky to have you step in and give him an alternative point of view for all the other.
Yeah,
things.
And you know, and I did it in a way where I was like, I just want to let him know that he's like, he's really good. I'm like, you're a really good comic. Like, you don't want to like ruin really good with something that's mediocre, like to fall into that trap of like, it will work. Like, yeah, if you go up and then I'll get a big laugh, but would you laugh at it? And would you laugh at it when you're doing comedy for 10 years?
Right.
If not, you probably shouldn't do it because you're capable of more and you don't need to do it. It's not like you're headlining every weekend. It's the same crowd. They need to see new material. Like, you can come up with better shit, you know?
Wow. So how do you see that? Because I see great parallels between the development of a stand-up set and then also the voice of like a podcast. Because a podcast definitely has a, I mean, like you, it has a point of view that begins to take on a life of its own, and it does develop over time. So how do you see where you've come in 5 years with the podcast? You know, from starting on Ustream to now, like what have you taken away from that, or how do you think it's grown?
Well, I think conversation is as much of an art form as, it's not as technical as like music or stand up, but the way you talk and the way you come off to other people and the awareness that you have and how to manage a conversation and being a conversationalist, there's an art to it, and you get better at it the more you do it. And if you do it a lot, you understand. And also, if you listen to other people that suck at it, that helps too. Like people that are like interrupting everybody and jamming their own shit down. Like some people can't let other people talk. They just can't. And when you see that, you go, ooh, that's kind of gross. And like just seeing someone who like stumbles over, and it's not like talking over, like there's always going to be like people where there's like runoff. Everybody runs off onto each other, and it's totally normal and sounds cool. But there's some people that, I think I read a quote once, was like, the wrong way to have a conversation is to think, when is it my turn?
Right.
You know, and there are some people that are like, are you even listening to me? Like, right. You're not even listening to me. You're just waiting for your turn, you know? And that's not, you know, that's not fun to listen to. And so you get better at that.
But it takes time to really, because I think, you know, we used to get shit at the beginning of our podcast for interrupting people because everyone just got super excited.
Yeah.
And it really took a really long time to get comfortable and to get better at it and to understand where the air is. And beyond that, I have to say that the podcast, like I've been able to apply some of the tool sets like on a date. Like I'm better on a date than I was years ago.
Oh yeah.
Because I feel I sort of have this weird skill set now where I can just sit down and actually talk to someone about themselves.
Which
and,
is rare.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah, but to that point of like, I think when you're first starting the podcast, you're always worried about air.
Yeah.
You're always worried about a second of silence.
Right.
And then what I realized, like, not, you know, a couple years ago was just like listening to things I love, like Stern or BS Report being one of my favorite podcasts. Like there's moments where there's air, but you never think about the air because you feel like you're there listening to the conversation. So the air is like, whenever you're listening to new podcasts, they will not let there be a second of fucking silence.
Right.
It's just boom, boom, boom. Regardless of whatever you're saying. If it's pointless, they're going to say something.
That was us for the first 2 years.
Yeah.
It really is something you get better at, and I didn't think it was going to be. I thought you either were interesting and you could talk, or you weren't, and that's just it. You know, you're a fully developed human being. You're an adult. Either you suck at this or it's going to work. But no, you really do get better at it, and you just, you know, it's like anything else. It becomes a skill.
Has anyone hit the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours of podcasting yet?
I wonder.
I don't even think. I mean, that would be a pretty amazing,
a pretty lengthy feat.
Because we're about to hit episode 600,
right? And that's
but this one will be past 600. I think you'll be 600.
You're episode 600,
Logan. You're episode 600. That's very special. So 600 episodes, which really, you know, when you, I mean, there's
some are an hour and a half, some are 40 minutes.
So let's say it's roughly, but it's roughly like an hour, 15 minutes. So let's say it's roughly 800, 900 hours of podcasting, which I think is 800 hours of podcasting.
One-tenth of the way there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still 10,000 hours.
I'm not sure if I buy that anyway, that Malcolm Gladwell thing. I think intensity and focus are sometimes as important, if not more, than the amount of time you put in.
But I think, like, even I say, if someone's doing something for 5,000 hours, you're probably pretty good at it.
They're pretty
probably,
good.
You know?
1,000 hours is also a lot of hours.
Yeah. Sure.
It's, if you practice the guitar for 1,000 hours,
oh my God.
You'd be really fucking good.
Fuck yeah.
At the guitar.
I wish I had 1,000 hours.
But if you think about how much time, like how long have you been doing stand-up?
Since 98.
Think about that. Think about all those years of doing stand-up, all those sets, two on a Friday, sometimes three on Saturday, one on Sunday. If they rope you into working Wednesday and Thursday, you're there too.
Well, I wasn't, you know, back then, I was just doing open mics. I mean, it took quite a few years before I was able to have enough to go on the road. And when I did go on the road, I realized that everything I learned about comedy in Los Angeles did not work on the road.
Oh.
And so
well, you were doing alternative rooms?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's why my style now is like, I have a set, but it changes because I talk to the audience. Like 40% of what I do is just talking to people on stage, which is something that developed because I did not have enough material when I started headlining. And so literally the only thing I could do to fill the time was just to talk to people in the audience. So that was a survival mechanism that ended up becoming like part of what I do, which is kind of funny.
That's interesting. Well, you started doing comedy when you were already famous. That's brave.
But I had no...
He's not wrong.
I had no issue with like just... I mean, like I realized I was enough of a comedy fan to know, and I'd bombed a few times in front of bigger rooms where I was like, it doesn't matter that I was on television. I need to start from scratch.
Yeah.
And so I just... I mean, I guess in a way it was kind of funny because I'd been on television for every day for like 4 years, but then I would just turn up to an open mic and sign up
just like, smart.
Like everybody else. And I just wanted to learn how to do it before. I did not have an ego about like, well, I should be doing, but I was like, no, I'm not good enough. I need to learn how to do this.
Well, I was there for Michael Richards when he first started doing stand-up again. I wasn't there for the infamous Laugh Factory night, but I was there when he first started doing stand-up after Seinfeld, and it was fucking really weird because he would come into the Comedy Store and everybody would be so happy to see him.
For a minute.
Yes. For maybe even 2 minutes. You know, and he'd do like a couple of pratfalls, and who are you? Where did I get here? And everybody like, he's Kramer. He's amazing.
This is going to be the best show we've ever seen.
And then, you know, you have a 15-minute set, and somewhere in, you know, minute five or six, they realize this is never getting any better than this.
Wow.
Like, what he's doing on stage is like, this is, we're going to have to sit through another 9 minutes of this horse shit. And he was awful.
Which is even worse because...
Way worse.
Because if they didn't know who he was, then they would maybe be a little more forgiving. But he comes in and it's like, that guy.
Yes.
I
mean,
I think
the janitor from UHF.
Stanley Spadowski?
Yes.
I think it's sort of that Chris Rock thing of, you know, it's like they don't give you... They almost dock more points off you if you're not funny because they're like... This is supposed to be what the expectations are so high.
Yes. Well, Charlie Murphy's another guy who got famous first and then started doing stand-up.
Right.
And he was headlining like a year into his stand-up comedy career.
Couldn't believe
it. When we went on the road together, he had done stand-up for fucking maybe 3 years. And it was me and him and John Heffron. We did this Bud Light comedy tour. We did like 22 dates. And he and I alternated between who closed the show.
Wow.
3 years in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. In front of thousands of people. You know, giant places, like 2,000
That's maybe too
people.
Soon to be headlining for
But he's got fucking balls. I mean, and he did not want to switch the position. Like, he wanted to do the same thing. Just, we'll alter every time. You know, I'll headline one, he'll headline the next one.
Wow.
Like, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, but he took his lumps, went up there like a man, just did it.
Those are serious lumps. Although, you know what I find is that... Because I did the Oddball tour, and the biggest crowd was like 22,000 people.
God, that's so crazy.
And I had no – it's funny. I don't really get nervous for big numbers, but I get nervous if I'm going into a room and there's like 50 people. You know what I mean? Like there's something – because it's so much more intimate, and you feel – and I feel so much more responsible, and you can see everyone.
Yeah.
And then I just feel more accountable in a much smaller group than thousands of people.
Yeah, no, that's totally understandable. I think that the small rooms are super important for cutting the fat out of your material.
Yes.
Because you could get away with like what Tommy Segura calls dance moves. Tom Segura calls, you know, like when you're like jazzing up something in front of a big crowd, like you can get away with a lot of bullshit. But if there's only like two people in the room, that bullshit just doesn't fly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you feel like what's fake about your act. Like it's like those late night sets at the store especially like are really important for that. And even if the improv as well, like there's something about also if it's in Hollywood, like my God, they've seen fucking everybody. Everybody's here. Mm-hmm. They're here all the time. Like and any given night you'll see 100 famous comedians, you know, floating throughout the clubs in the city. You know, so because of that, the audience is like super used to that. Mm-hmm. They're used to like a high level of comedy. And so like you got to cut all, and if especially it's like late night, you go up after they've seen like 7 comedians, you know, the show's an hour and 90 minutes old.
That's 2.5 hours, Jeff.
I know what it is. It's a joke. The idea of doing stand-up in a big crowded room is like this contagious laughter. It's very, you know, it catches on and everybody gets into it and you feel the energy from the room. But when there's no energy in the room, it's just a few people. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Chris Hardwick.
Hey, guys.
So, this is going to sound crazy, you know, and then you feel that weirdness, like with the silence in between the bits and the lack of noise in the room, and it just really makes you aware of how much of your act is horseshit, you know?
I love dance moves.
That's so funny.
But if I were to get up and there were just like 4 people in the audience, I would probably just sit down at their table and just talk to them.
That's not bad.
As opposed to, because I feel weird. I feel weird not acknowledging whatever the current environment is, that the situation is.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not one of those guys where it's like, it doesn't matter if there's 4 people in there. You get up there and you do your act the way if there were 40,000 people.
Do your routine.
Then you're, yeah. Because I just feel like, hey, they know the deal. I know the deal. Why don't I just be honest about it and go like, hey, this is strange. Let's all just talk to each other instead of me pretending that, you know, you're more people than you are.
Well, but then maybe they would get annoyed because, like, hey, we came to see some fucking comedy. We didn't come to have a conversation with you, dude.
Yeah, but it's your fault that more people didn't show up.
I did Dangerfields in New York City once. And Dangerfields, there was a guy named Bobby that used to work the door at Dangerfields. He was this big Scottish guy. He was, like, a big character. He's probably funnier than any of the comedians that worked there, including me. And I showed up there. I think I had, like, maybe like a 9 o'clock spot. And I showed up there like 8:45 and all the comics were like hanging out by the bar. And I was like, what's going on? How's the show? And they're like, there's no one in there. I go, no one? Like the show probably started at 8. I go, no one's in there. Like no one's in there. I'm like, whoa. And right when I said that, 2 people walked up, they bought tickets and Bobby said, come right here, right this way. He brought him into the room and he goes, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome your host. And these 2 people sat down and they're like, oh no.
he didn't give them time to get up and leave.
No, he just sat them down and introduced the host and the host went up. And at Dangerfields, you do like a half an hour. So there was like 2 guys before me. They did a half an hour. And or it was like the host maybe did 15 minutes and a guy did a half an hour and then I did a half an hour in front of 2 people.
Wow.
And they never left. They sat there through the whole
show.
Good
for them.
Yeah.
That is just a severe guilt complex they had. They were like, I want to leave.
It was a little bit of that, but they were smiling and laughing. They had some drinks and, you know, it was decent comics, you know. Yeah. So, have you ever been to Dangerfields?
No.
It's where Roddy Dangerfield had that HBO special.
The Young Comedian special.
Yes, with Kinison, Dice Clay.
That was the 9th annual Young Comedian. That was the 9th annual Young Comedian special.
9th annual? Was it really?
The 9th one was Kinison, Saget, Louis Anderson, Rita Rudner. This guy named Bob Nelson, who was great.
Yeah.
Dice
Jiffy Jeff's Gym.
Dice wasn't on that. Yeah, Jeff's Gym. He didn't do... I don't think he did the Jeff's Gym bit on that one. He did the football players.
Yeah.
He was like, number 72. Yeah. Oh, shit, 27. Yeah. You know, he did that guy. Dice was later because the 9th annual Dangerfield special was in like 84, maybe?
But Dice, 84? Hicks. When was Kinison? Kinison was
the 9th annual. Saget was on that one, too. It was like 84, maybe. The ninth annual Young Rodney Dangerfield's Young Comedians was HBO Young Comedian special, and I think that was the ninth annual one. And at that point, might have been like
it was 84.
84. Yeah.
Yakov Smirnoff.
Yakov Smirnoff, too.
Branson's own Yakov Smirnoff.
Regis Philbin did a cameo on it.
Regis Philbin?
He didn't perform. He just did a cameo in it. Yeah. He introduced Rodney at the top of the show. I watched the shit out of that tape. My parents let me watch whatever, comedy-wise, because they fed that. And so I had the ninth annual comedian tape, and I watched that fucking special over and over.
They must be so psyched that you're a comic. Like, if they just fed that, that's
yeah. They always kind of knew. They always kind of knew. And you know, my parents were cool. They were like, "Hey, man, do what makes you happy." You know, they weren't like hippy dippy parents. Like, you know, just feel your way. Like, they were like, "If this is what you want to do, you should do it because it makes you happy." And so they gave me every Steve Martin record, everything. Wow. Yeah, I was very lucky.
That's cool.
They fostered that early on. That's but we're here to talk about your comedy special, which is Friday, November 21st.
Yeah, this Friday.
What's it called and what time is it on?
It's called Rocky Mountain High. It's on Friday night at midnight. I did it in Denver for a bunch of reasons. One, because Denver, the club, Wendy, who owns a club, is Wendy Curtis, who's like one of the nicest people
ever, very
sweet. Stand-up. She's responsible for the entire scene in Denver. It rests on her shoulders. It truly rests on her shoulders. If it wasn't for her, there would be no scene in Denver. I mean, she fosters this open mic program there. She allows people to come up through the ranks and become middle acts and then eventually become headliners. It's one of the few places in the country where she'll develop like homegrown headliners. Mm-hmm. And she's so good to comics when they come there from the road. She's so nice, and I always loved working there. And I haven't worked there in years. I've been doing theaters in Denver for years. But I decided, like, I just want to do that club. And I want to do it, like, right after marijuana became legal. Mm-hmm. I was like, that's it. I'm going to Denver. Like, I was just – I had, like, a short list. The other idea was, like, do it in Alaska. I was going to do one in Alaska in Anchorage because I think those people are fucking gangster as shit. They're just living out in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
barely a part of America. You know, like, they're living in a place where it doesn't get dark in the summer and it doesn't get light in the winter. And they're crazy. And they're fun as shit. I don't know if you ever performed in Anchorage. Have you ever been up there?
No, I haven't performed there.
Fucking love it.
Okay.
Love it.
Okay.
I love the people up there. They have this amazing sense of community because they might get stomped to death by a moose.
Right.
You know, like,
they have to,
you have
each other
to, like,
to stay alive.
You have to, like, you know, worry about bears and shit. You know, I mean, you're literally in the wilderness. You are actually in the wilderness, and you have a city that is just like this goofy little spot surrounded by, like, the most wild country known to man.
And elements and everything else.
It's everything. It is
bears that are 14 feet tall when they stand on their hind legs.
Yeah, what the fuck, man? I mean, like, everything about it is amazing. It's beautiful up there, and the people are so friendly. And super progressive. Like, that's one of the things that I found was amazing when I was up there. There was, like, this honk for marriage equality thing that these people had on this corner. And they had, like, you know, the rainbow flags and shit. And everybody was going by honking at them and waving and everything. I was like, whoa, Alaska is wild. It's, like, so different than what you would think it was.
So you chose Denver.
Yeah.
Because marijuana had just become legal, and it's a great city. And went
I love great. It there. I love Colorado. I think it's I have an affinity to mountains and to natural beauty, and I think that that's something that people really take for granted, in a sense of, like, people appreciate artwork. Like, you pay a lot of money to buy a painting, and people love to go to museums and galleries, but all that is nonsense in comparison to, like, driving up, like, left-hand canyon road up into Boulder, and you're driving into the mountains, and as you're driving up there, you're like, holy shit, look at that. Snow-capped mountains and the trees, and, like, slow down, there's a fox in the road, and, like, some fox runs across the road, and you're like, what the fuck? It's so, like, exhilarating. And I think one of the reasons why people in Denver and Boulder and that whole area are so cool is because they're confronted by just this inescapable power of nature, because it's so massive. The mountain is so huge and so gorgeous. It's like it chills you out because, like, you ain't shit. Like, you take yourself seriously. It's one of the reasons why beach towns are so cool. Like, you're right next to a massive body of water that's just letting you know.
Just chill out.
Just chill the fuck out, yeah, dude. Yeah. Relax.
There are bigger things than you.
Yeah, don't take it seriously. Just look right there. Look at that. And I think that I was drawn to Colorado in a lot of ways because of that. And that's why I moved there for a short period of time. But it's there's something about that area that I find, like, incredibly compelling.
Well, not surprisingly, you were a fantastic guest. And I'm so glad to finally have you on after all this time for our 600th episode.
I'm so honored.
This was very special. It was great. You're having a special Friday, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Joe. Good to see you, too. Thank you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Yay.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.